Case number 12-5327, Roy A. Daniel et al. Appellant v. Isaac Fullwood, Jr., Chairman of the United States Parole Commission et al. Mr. Fowler for the appellants, Mr. Birch.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good
morning.
May it please the Court, I'm Kenneth Fowler representing the appellants in this action. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. There are three appellants remaining in the case, Percy Jeter, Abu Shahid Ali, and William Terry. All are D.C. offenders who committed crimes before March 3, 1985, when the 1972 parole regulations were in effect. Question on this appeal is whether they've stated a claim for violation of the ex post facto clause in their complaint against the commissioners of the United States Parole Commission. We submit that they clearly have. As the complaint explains in detail, under the 1972 regulations, the prisoner was eligible for release upon service of his minimum sentence. In the ordinary course, would have been considered suitable for release shortly thereafter, regardless of the death of a victim. By contrast, under the 2000 guidelines, there's an automatic addition of 5 to 7 points, which for these particular prisoners, for example, has translated into 6 to 18 months to their parole eligibility guideline ranges.
Is that true regardless of the death of the victim? Isn't our language in the 72 guidelines that could refer to the death of the victim?
The 72 regulations, there were no guidelines under them.
Yes, did
refer that the D.C. Parole Board could consider circumstances around the crime that would include the death of a victim. That's also...
So it's not a new concept.
It's not a new concept, but it's weighted very differently, Your Honor.
How is it? What indication do we have how it's weighted in 72?
The core indication that we have, and that my clients have pled, Your Honor, and we're not here asking the court to find this to be the case. We're asking the court simply to find that we've stated a claim and to permit discovery into this. But we have alleged that the 1987 guidelines implemented by the D.C. Parole Board, based on, among other things, sampling and testing of outcomes, 402 outcomes under the 1972 policies and procedures of the board, that the 1987 guidelines reached the same results. That while they may have been implementing a new methodology, they were essentially simply formalizing the practices and procedures of the board. And those...
Can you make your case without the 87 guidelines?
I think, Your Honor, we can. We can certainly make the case.
Make the case as you're entitled, that you've pled adequately.
Yes, I believe we have pled adequately, Your Honor, and in detail.
How would you make it without the reference to the 87 guidelines?
We would seek discovery, Your Honor.
No, based on your pleading now.
Based on the pleading, I do believe we need to reference in the 1987 guidelines.
You have to have the 87 guidelines. Without it, you lose.
I don't believe we do lose, Your Honor. I believe our pleadings are detailed, plausible, and non-speculative.
Let me hear you make the argument without the 87 guidelines. I'm not so impressed with the 87 guidelines.
For example, Your Honor, the 1972 regulations say a number of things will be taken into account. One of those things that's taken into account in the plain language of the regulations in a much greater manner than you have under the 2000 guidelines is good behavior, positive program performance, achievement while in prison. That is heavily discounted and comes into play only after the addition of many, many more years under the new 2000 guidelines. That, for example, right on the face of the 1972 regulations is a difference. And we submit that facial difference, you look at the language of Garner and Fletcher, and that facial difference should be enough to get us into discovery. What we're asking for, Your Honor, is the opportunity to have discovery about how the 1972 regulations were actually applied.
I thought the argument that you began with, Judge Silberman, which was then the difference between the 87 and the 2000, maybe I misinterpreted your complaint, but I thought you were making the same argument with respect to the comparison between 1972 and 2000, that in 2000 the guidelines created presumption and that in the absence of unusual circumstances, the board could not go go below, while the original 72 guideline factors don't create any kind of presumption, and that if you have the engine of a presumption, it's more likely that a higher sentence will occur than if you have no presumption at all.
That is correct.
Is that not right? So that the 87 guidelines could fall out altogether from this argument and still have basically the same argument. All you're saying with respect to 87 is it's more clear than it was in the 72 guidelines. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
That's what I thought you were going to argue.
So you just to put the finer point on it, the government says that your second and third grounds for relief are contingent on your prevailing on the notion that 87 merely formalizes or codifies 72, and you're saying that that's not correct, that you independently have an argument regardless of 87 that goes back to 72.
That is correct, Your Honor. Your Honors, there are different additional differences between the application.
Yeah, what about the three-year point? The three-year point.
I'm sorry, Judge Silverman, the three-year point.
Well, one of the arguments you make, is it not that the regimen are different compared with respect to misdeeds committed in prison within 3 years of release?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. We do make that argument.
I'm glad I helped.
And I appreciate the help of each of the judges so far this morning. Mm-hmm. Yes, we do make that argument.
Why don't you spell it out?
And that argument is that under the 2000 guidelines, there is a complete look-back period with respect to disciplinary infractions. Whereas under the 1972 guidelines, there was no factor focused on discipline or bad behavior. So if we're still talking about looking just at that, again, you don't need the 1987 guidelines to state that claim.
But the 72 guidelines say, among others.
That's right? Correct. Among other factors.
So this wouldn't be excluded. Disciplinary infractions wouldn't be excluded by the 72 guidelines. 72 factors, right?
No. What we would see, though, is when we look at the 1987 guidelines, they consider whether minor offenses were committed twice.
We're going to go to 2000. We're trying to avoid 87. Go right from 72 to 2000.
Yes, Your Honor. Comparing 72 to 2000, there's no factor in 1972 that focuses specifically on discipline or bad behavior. There's no factor that automatically takes points off, and the focus is instead on total institutional experience. There's also, as you see from reading the regulations in 1972, there is a much more extensive discussion of matters that are considered in terms of institutional experience than that are actually given credit for under the 2000 guidelines. The other problem under 2000 is that the institutional experience comes off at the end of a long initial period of additional time that's been added for offense accountability. Your Honor, we would like to rely as well on the 1987 guidelines, if I may move on to that. Mm-hmm. We have pled that the 87 guidelines articulated the practices and policies of the board under the 1972 regulations. We know that from the Selman decision that only by departing from its ordinary procedures and presumptions can the parole commission attain the same result under the 2000 guidelines that was directed by the 1987. Therefore, we would submit that this pleading states a case. There are at least four reasons why we think the court below and the commission is incorrect when they find this pleading to be implausible or speculative. We're pleading a matter that has already been determined by a decision of the D.C. Court of Appeals in Davis versus Henderson. We're not saying that this court is bound by a finding in Davis versus Henderson as to whether an ex post facto violation was committed, but we are saying that it is at a minimum plausible under Iqbal, Twombly, and 12b-6 for the appellants to plead that the 87 guidelines merely formalized the
1987 guidelines say?
I'm sorry, that the 1987 guidelines merely formalized the 1972 regulations.
And what do the 87 guidelines say about the presumption? So that is, what's the difference with respect to the unusual circumstances provision in the 2000 guidelines, 87 says?
The difference is, under the 2000 guidelines, there's an automatic addition for the death of a victim.
That wasn't what I was. I understand that point, but at the end, when you get to the end, the 2000 guidelines provide a going below an unusual.
Only an unusual.
And what did the 87 guidelines say?
The 87 guidelines. So instead of having a presumption that there's going to be a strong addition that can only be departed from an unusual circumstances, the 87 guidelines had a point score system. The points were worth a lot more. 1 point would be added, but only 1 point for offense accountability. So, for example, if there was a record of sustained program achievement at a hearing or a rehearing, an inmate could receive credit for that, and that would then offset that original additional point that was added for the offense accountability. The parole commission can only depart downwards in its discretion. In unusual circumstances, under 87, additional time could have been added. But if we're looking at a significant risk of prolonged incarceration, well, we would submit, Your Honors, that having to show unusual circumstances or extraordinary circumstances under the 2000 guidelines is an almost impossible burden for a typical inmate in prison, and that a great...
Both 87 and 2000 use unusual circumstances as the standard at the end of the day.
Yes, or extraordinary. But the difference is that it's only added under 87, whereas it has to be shown to remove these additional points under 2000. You've got a flipped presumption working against the...
I'm sorry,
the
explain that again. Only added?
It's under the 2000 guidelines, and I'm sorry I'm not being very clear, Your Honor, you have to show unusual circumstances. That's the only way a prisoner can get out from under this automatic addition of 5 to 7 points. There's a presumption that's operating against him.
And in the 87?
In the 87, the commission always, or the parole board always had the ability to depart upwards, but that departure could only, only occur if there were extraordinary circumstances or something unusual. So the presumption was there would not be anything more than a point added for victim, the severity of the offense.
That's all. Are you only talking about the, you want to consult for one second?
Counsel, isn't one of your arguments here that if we affirm the district court, we are creating a circuit conflict?
I do believe that would be the case, Your Honor.
Because of the Third Circuit opinion?
Because of the Third Circuit decision.
It doesn't matter, though, it's unpublished, or does it?
Certainly the Third Circuit, I don't think I'm prepared to address that, Your Honor. It would certainly mean that different standards...
I would have thought you would have thought about that.
About the publication,
Yes, whether it creates a circuit conflict if the Third Circuit opinion is unpublished.
I believe, as a practical matter, you have the two circuits applying the law in different ways, which then means there's a real difference.
What's the year of the Third Circuit decision?
Brown versus Williamson is...
It's recent, right?
Recent, yeah.
Relatively recent.
And
yes,
the federal rules have been changed to require, whether you publish or not, that it be precedential. Used to be up to the circuit. It's not up to the circuit anymore.
Yes, but I am pausing because I'm not sure if Brown versus Williamson was before or after that change.
What year did you say? Pretty sure it's
2009,
after.
Your Honor.
I'm pretty sure that's after.
Yeah, I think it's after.
I believe that is after.
So you have an our circuit conflict argument.
I believe we do, Your Honor.
You probably have it anyway, but whether published or not, but yeah, at least you have it.
And it's a very real conflict problem because 18 to 24% of the D.C. code offenders serve their time in the Middle District of Pennsylvania. Also, have a Middle District of Pennsylvania case, Quifery, which finds that this is adequate to state a case using the 1987 guidelines.
What percent? I didn't realize.
I believe it's 18 to 24% of D.C. code offenders are serving their time in the Middle District of Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
If Your Honors have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Hearing none, we'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court. Good morning. Alan Birch on behalf of the United States. I think the core place to start here is the where Judge Urbina pointed out in footnote 6 of his opinion that the record has done nothing to establish when they likely would have been paroled under the 72 regulations. And it's a necessary predicate to make any kind of intelligible comparison to how they're being treated under the current system. Indeed, Judge Urbina invited the prisoners to come back on reconsideration and explain how they would fill this key factual gap. Their motion for reconsideration when addressing that point, which appears in the appendix on 275-76, essentially says, give us discovery, we'll fill the hole. That simply cannot satisfy the pleading requirements under Twombly and Iqbal. On their brief in...
Well, it seems to me they've done a little bit more than that, because there's the undeniable reality on the face of the provisions that there's an automatic bump up in 2000, and there was no automatic bump up in 87. In 72.
In 72, there was nothing even remotely comparable. There wasn't even a range. There was nothing. So the record here establishes nothing about what the likely outcome would have been.
But how can they establish anything if 72 was essentially just a list of considerations to be taken into account at the discretion of the decision maker?
I think it would be very difficult. Perhaps they could try that on a statistical summary. They have not set that out in their complaint. They have not pled that in their complaint.
But how are they going to do that without discovery? The statistics belong to you, not to them.
Well, to the extent that they may exist, there is a regulation that makes much of this information public with respect to the parole outcomes. 28 CFR 2.37C specifies particular information that's public with respect to the name of the prisoner, the sentence, the crime, the parole hearings, the outcome. But there's nothing that you need to plead a case first before you get into discovery. Now,
all right, let me give you a hypothetical. Let's suppose a 72 guidelines, whatever you say, simply say total discretion on the part of the parole board. Nothing more. Total discretion on the part of the parole board. And in 2000, it says parole may not be granted in a murder case short of the sentence. Maximum sentence.
Sort of the maximum sentence.
Yes.
The statutory maximum.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What result?
That would be a much closer case, I think.
What result?
I still think you would need to know something about the 72.
You'd have to plead something about.
Plead
the 72.
Something or two about the 72.
You'd have to plead. What would you have to plead?
You'd have to plead that the parole board.
You would occasionally grant parole under certain circumstances that don't comply with this requirement.
I would think you'd have to do a little more than occasionally.
But how do you know that without discovery?
Like I said, it should be public information about these parole outcomes, and you can presumably request that under FOIA or elsewise. I mean,
in other words, you use FOIA rather than discovery.
You need to have a case first before you sue. You need to know that have a factual basis, and you need to explain the factual basis. The key of the pleading standards under Twombly and Iqbal is to provide enough of a factual basis that the court can assess whether this is plausible, rather than simply saying, we're going to trust plaintiff's counsel because they think there might be a case here, and then let them go and see if there is. You need to have something to make an assessment. And if there's nothing about what the outcomes were, you have nothing to make an assessment of the plausibility of the claim. That's the fundamental problem. Now, they try in their reply brief to glom on to part of their report from 87, and this is at page 138 of the appendix, the quote from the report, which talks about distribution curves and comparing the distribution curves. But these are not, neither one of the curves are when people were paroled under 72. They have nothing on that. Indeed, they try to patch that hole again by referencing Davis versus Henderson. Davis versus Henderson does not make that comparison. Davis versus Henderson focuses on a different aspect of the statistical angle, which is not the mean or the average, but the variation. Davis versus Henderson, the core of that is that the discretion remains.
What about the concern of creating a circuit conflict?
Well, I believe that Brown versus Williamson is very clearly wrongly decided on several aspects. So if there is a conflict, then I think that because it was published in 2000 or it was decided in 2009, I believe the rule change was in 2007. And so, yes, it would be. The errors in Brown are fairly obvious and many. At several points, it misstates the Garner standard as it, quote, might pose a significant risk as opposed to creating a significant risk. It also puts the discovery cart before the horse. Finally, if you were to pull up the petition filed in Brown, you would see that it is purely conclusory and simply cannot survive a Twombly-Iqbal analysis. Indeed, it simply pleads that the prisoner, quote, was seen by a parole commission examiner using new guidelines that did not apply to him, end quote. That clearly has to fall on Twombly-Iqbal. So Brown versus Williamson, we believe, is wrongly decided. It would create a conflict potentially to, depending on how broadly the court rules. But the
why, if I could rephrase the argument that I asked about in the opposing counsel, you have a set of rules that are completely discretionary, and then you have a set of rules that constrain the parole commission's discretion, and in particular with respect to violent criminals that lead to a higher sentence, which is presumptive. Why doesn't that create a significant risk? That's all that's required by Gardner, is a significant risk. Why isn't that enough to create a significant risk?
Because you still need to get back to making a comparison to how things were. If the old system was...
The way they were before was completely discretionary on its face.
Right, but that doesn't say... That speaks to both variation and predictability. It doesn't speak to average time. It may very well be that they very rarely use their discretion and that they kept people in the maximum time as a matter of course.
That may very well be true, but we're only on the question now of a pleading standard.
Right.
And why can't we read the face of the initial regulations, which say complete discretion, and the face of the others, which say if you do these things, you're going to get these sentences? Why isn't that enough to lead to discovery, at least?
Because they haven't given you a fact to analyze about how plausible it is as to what the average time
is. I'm asking you, why isn't it plausible for at this point to infer that when you have complete discretion, you may have a lower sentence than when you're constrained to a quite specific and high sentence for particular kinds of defendants?
I would submit, Chief Judge Garland, that falls squarely in the Twombly language of pleading language, pleading behavior that may be consistent with violative conduct, but does not necessarily go the extra step and make it plausible.
I didn't think the Twombly language was all so crystal clear.
I'm sorry?
I didn't think the Twombly language was all so crystal clear as you're describing.
The difference is, as I see it, is do you have a fact that allows the court to make a screening determination of how plausible this is?
Twombly does point out that you have to look practically to see how it was implemented.
Right, and there was nothing in the complaint here that establishes that, how it was implemented in the past.
Pleading had alleged that in 72, although there was great discretion, it was handled in a more benign fashion than was true under 2000, that's okay then? Then the pleading is all right?
That's a baby step in the right direction. It's still not sufficient because it doesn't do enough under this court's holding in Phillips or the Fletcher to make a specific showing with respect to this particular prisoner.
One thing that they do know about is their own characteristics and the way that their own characteristics have been construed under the 2000 rules, and they do set out a number of allegations in the complaint about how they might have fared under 1972. So there are specific,
but they're very conclusory. They're just simply let's point to particular aspects of the complaint. I mean, the complaint, when it talks about this, says things like we would have been this factor would have been weighted more heavily or was emphasized differently. Nothing about scope or scale, nothing that is necessarily specific to them that makes you that gives you the ability to analyze whether this could meet the Garner standard or not.
And
it's simply
to
trust us, we were treated
worse
enough.
What they need to show is a plausible claim of a significant risk.
Sorry?
They need to make a plausible showing of a significant risk.
Right. That's why this complaint is deficient. And for
why, if I could just refer to the 87 guidelines for a moment,
sure.
Not for the proposition of what they specifically would have led to, but whether the statement of policy and procedures issued by the Parole Commission at the time, which said all we're doing here is making explicit the factors that we've been using, why doesn't that create at least plausibility for the proposition that these presumptions wouldn't have applied under 72? I'm not saying that it would resolve the question. I'm not saying that it establishes that 87 and 72 are the same, but it does suggest that they were intending only to clarify and make explicit factors that they were using before.
I think because of the wholesale nature of the change and the lack of any validation or either studying-wise or language saying we intend to keep the time to parole the same.
Well, that's a different question. I'm talking about hold for 1 second. Mm. It says to make explicit the factors that we were considering. So if before, under 72, they said it a certain way, 87 says it a way that doesn't create the kind of presumptions that we now have, doesn't that suggest that in 72 they weren't creating the presumptions that we now have? Just from a point of view of plausibility.
In terms of presumptions, yes, of course, but that is one, you have to put that in context of the wholesale change of the system. And if the baseline is unknown as to how long would a board let someone go past, would the board have let someone go past their minimum before they would typically engage in an analysis of the same factors under different presumptions. If you don't know that, you can't make the intelligible comparison. I think the fairest reading of the report and Davis is that the change was made to make things not only more reliable, but also to make them more sort of validatable with respect to parole outcomes. And indeed, that's what the report is talking about at page 138 of the appendix, the quoted language that they rely on. The two curves that are referred to there are the first is the risk factor under the 87 guidelines, and the second curve is how well did the parolees do on parole? Did they have their parole revoked? And so they're trying to validate whether this system is a good predictor, whether someone should be on parole. And they're trying to do that and at the same time make these parole outcomes more predictable and reliable. The language of the report does nothing to say we're specifically aiming at the same results, either higher or lower, in terms of how long people stayed in jail before they're paroled. That's the overriding hole in this case.
Why doesn't Davis, for purposes of plausibility, not for purposes of a final decision, get you to plausibility? The new District of Columbia parole guidelines merely formalize the manner in which the board exercises the discretion conferred upon it by the statute.
Well, two responses. I think the first is simply that if you put that in context of how I think Davis should be read, which is that the core of Davis is going to the discretionary aspect, which says more about the variation and the lack of validation with respect to parole outcomes than it does to the mean time. And so it's not saying that this new system is giving us the same results, either on a whole or for any particular subpopulation.
Did Brown say that?
Brown relied on Davis and took it one step further and said it's not just sort of procedural, but substantive.
Right.
And that's, I think, another way that Brown errs by extending Davis even farther than the language of Davis.
But in terms of plausibility, Brown has a statement that the scoring system implemented in 1987 under District of Columbia law implemented no significant substantive changes.
Yes, exactly. No significant substantive changes. And that goes even farther than the language in Davis. But the second thing I would say to Chief Judge Garland's question is that a complaint needs to plead the factual allegations. You can't simply say, well, let's look at this other district, or look at this other court decision. which dealt with different prisoners with a different background, different parole.
I'm not talking about Brown. I'm talking about Davis.
Right.
This is D.C. Court of Appeals explaining a question of D.C. law. What was the purpose of the new guidelines?
I think,
and the question is whether I understand why that might not be enough to resolve the ex post facto question. Question: why isn't that enough to resolve the plausibility question?
Because the for two reasons. One, Davis is not the substitute. It can't be a substitute for a factual pleading. And second,
wait a minute. I want to stop you there for a moment. Suppose Davis held that the 87 guidelines simply reflect exactly accurately what the practice was in 72. Are you seriously arguing that a pleading that relied on that statement would not qualify as a plausible articulation as a factual matter of a significant risk?
At that level of generality, yes, because you still need to tie it to the specific prisoner and the specific prisoner's outcomes. And to say that
absolute assurance on a court decision that the 87 guidelines reflect precisely the practice of 72.
I don't think that's with all respect.
Let's assume you had that.
If that's all we have, I think you need to look a little broader.
That still would not be enough as far as you're concerned.
Not in this context, because in this context it would not be plausible given the wholesale nature of the changes and the failure, as you set forth in your hypothetical, the continuing failure to say that this prisoner with these particular characteristics would have been treated exactly this way under this system and the old system.
Really? Imagine that the commission itself said, we are adopting in 87... all we're doing is saying what we've been doing all along. These are the presumptions that we've secretly been applying all along. These are the points, the way we've been doing it all along. They don't say anything about any particular prisoner, but they say these are the points that we've always done. Would that not be enough?
If they were to also plead that's how it worked out for them,
so the difference in the presumptions and the difference in the way the factors affect wouldn't matter. That's your position. You have to be able to prove it for these individuals.
Certainly have to be able to prove it for these individuals. Established.
Talk to me about United States versus Turner. That's the case in which we held, post-Booker, that when there are original set of sentencing guidelines, which post-Booker are discretionary, and a second set, and they change them and they raise them, commission changes them and raises them, still discretionary, that it would be an ex post facto violation to apply the second set to somebody who had the offense at the time of the first.
That sounds like one of the Garner, sort of what we call the step one of Garner, or the facial challenge, where you have otherwise comparable systems with a comparable provision changed and made sort of facially more harsh.
But there's discretion.
Sure. But that and the cases that have found ex post facto violations typically are situations like that. But
so
you don't have that
why
here.
Why isn't that my hypothetical, though? The hypothetical, again, I said, was that they're saying that the 72 guidelines are really the 87 guidelines are secretly the 72 guidelines.
Because it's just not plausible given the wholesale nature of the change. You don't have otherwise comparable systems.
It's not plausible. My hypothetical? Is that what you're saying? I'm not asking you to accept the hypothetical as fact for the purpose of the hypothetical.
No, what's not plausible is that given the change that actually happened here, in that you didn't have two otherwise comparable systems where one little provision of each of them, which corresponds to one another, was changed and made harsh. You have a completely different methodology altogether. And so when you pick out one provision over here, and there's nothing even remotely comparable on the first side, then the comparison just doesn't get you anywhere. You don't have any ability to assess how plausible it is. And that's where we are.
Well, we know for sure under the current system that Mr. Jeter, for example, gets base 8 points, right? There's no doubt about that. That's reflected in his report, which means has a base guideline range of 72 to 96 months. That's not hypothetical. That's what we know. And we may not know what his disciplinary fractions and superior program achievement was, but we know he's got that level before that. And we know that under the and we know that he can't get out of this now without the unusual circumstances. And we know that some number of those points were attributed specifically because of the nature of his offense in a way that they weren't under the 87 or under the 72 guidelines. So why isn't that enough to create a significant risk?
The same answer I gave before, because the comparison that you're making is to a complete unknown.
All right, here's suppose, let me take one more hypothetical. Suppose you have guideline 1, 72, presumption, a factor, presumption that a particular factor will reduce, will increase chances of parole. Simple proposition. A presumption that a particular factor will increase the chances of parole. In 2000, it's reversed. That same presumption will decrease chances of parole. What result?
If it's stated at that level of generality, I would submit that it's close but not quite enough. You would need a little bit more about how important the factor was, not a lot more, how important it was, how much of a difference it was likely to make.
I think that's an impossible position for you to take.
But the other thing that
I thought that would be the logical, your answer would be logical flowed from the rest of your
I think that that's very
the problem. The problem is it's a reductio ad absurdum.
Not at all, Your Honor, because one thing about your hypothetical is that it presumes that the rest of the system is stays the same.
Absolutely.
And so that's what puts it well within range of being plausible. It just needs a little bit more, because if the factor was something, I mean, you didn't tell us what the factor was. It was something that was, if it was very small, very rare, didn't come up very often,
well,
and
at least
didn't apply
know,
to these particular prisoners,
how about, no,
then
that's
it wouldn't
on
make
that
a difference.
One, suppose that there's at least the additional allegation that this factor has salience to the individual.
Yes, then I think you're there. Then I think you're likely there. But you need to tie it to the original, to the person, and you need to.
Well, that's true.
Yeah,
you're absolutely true. If it was a factor that couldn't possibly apply to these individuals, you're right.
Right, and
I'm assuming it would be a factor that would apply.
And something that was just not sort of so obscure that it would be very ridiculous to apply it to.
And here you have allegations in the complaint that these factors, that the ones that allegedly change, do have salience to the individuals.
They do have salience, yes, but it fails because of the inability to compare it to how they would have been treated under the old system. If there are no further questions, we would ask the court to affirm the judgment below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do the plaintiffs have any time? We'll give you another couple minutes if you need.
Just a very few responsive points, Your Honor. Again, we would focus on the importance of the automatic bump up and the presumption that is there in 2000, not there earlier. Secondly, we do not believe it is accurate that there is adequate publicly.
You mean a bump up because of the
offense of accountability, death of the victim, or other extreme circumstances. Secondly, it is not in our understanding the case that there is publicly available information that could replace discovery here. We're certainly entitled, if we've stated a claim under the federal rules, to discovery. We couldn't respond in any more detail to Judge Urbina's footnote 6 because that information is uniquely within the possession of the U.S. Parole Commission.
I don't recall. Was the argument about essentially this FOIA approach using the CFR, was that made before, that you could have gotten information that way?
I do not believe it's been made before, Your Honor, in this case. Thank you.
That was a question. You don't need to thank me for a question.
We had some comments from the Parole Commission that the 1987 report does not support, that it shows a, quote, wholesale change, that it doesn't support, along with the cases, the view that the 87 guidelines merely formalized. We would call attention to several points in the report, including at A136 and A138,
where the Parole Commission said that the D.C. Department of Corrections annual report from 1984 shows that many of the factors that seem to predict success or failure of D.C. offenders under the current parole supervision are included in the salient factors. We would submit under Gardner, Your Honors, that the policies and practices of the D.C. Parole Board are something that can be determined and are the best manner to determine how it exercises its discretion. We should be, we would submit, Your Honors, permitted to take discovery in that. And we would ask respectfully that the court reverse the decision of the district court and remand for discovery and trial.
No questions. We'll take this under submission. Thank you. We'll take a brief recess.